Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Oh, come on, Kirk, give me a break here. Let me hit record before we dive too deep into this topic. I'm recording now. So this is Fred Shankleberg. Okay. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability.
Hi, Fred. Hi, audience.
Yeah, and thanks for joining us. Kirk and I were just chatting about, well, what should we talk about next? And I hit a hot button, I guess. So, Kirk, yes. When I said, I said parts count prediction, and you were talking about seeing an advertisement for some software company saying, you know, the most widely used, and it was according to what, Mill Handbook 217, the most widely used and accepted. And that's where we both kind of lost it.
Right. This standard, and this is what they said, this standard, Mill Handbook 217, this standard remains one of the most widely used and accepted reliability prediction standards in use today. Okay. That in itself is a bit disturbing, since we know that the last revision of Mill Handbook 217, which was, I think, revision F, was over in 1995, and just think today how much change there has been in electronic components, assembly methods, materials, semiconductors since in 22 years, something ridiculous. It's just absurd that anybody would even consider this a possibly valid, since most of the components we use today certainly didn't exist and don't exist anymore from 22 years ago, except in the old pinball machines.
They're still working. Yeah.
Long beyond
their predicted lifetime.
Exactly. Right. They're 30 years old and they're still operating.
All right. So let's break this, their comments down a little bit. I think there's a couple of sides to that. Let's break that down a little bit. Before we dive into it, let's take a real short break for one of our messages, and we'll be right back.
Hi there, it's Fred here. Do you or those around you use MTBF? If so, I have to ask you why. Check out my short book, The Reliability Metric, a quick and valuable improvement over MTBF. In it, you will find details on how just poor metric MTBF is for reliability, and specifics on what you should do instead. A useful reliability metric will help you and your team make better decisions. To find out more and to get a copy, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/metric.
All right. So, Kirk, you're going to have to go to a Buddha or a yoga retreat center for the rest of the day to calm down from this one.
I understand why the effort of prediction continues today.
Well, let's start right there. There's in a development program or even in a purchasing type, I'm going to buy a system, I need a power supply, I'm going to buy it from vendor A. A useful question to ask is, well, how long will this power supply last? And we don't have any prototypes yet, we don't have anything. We need to answer the question at some point in our organization, will this last long enough for our application? Now, I think the question is valid. Going to Mill Handbook 217 or any of the parts count prediction things is just pure folly.
Right. Right.
And I think you and I can agree on that.
I think your question of will this component or subsystem last long enough? Not how long will it last, but will it be robust enough to last as long as we need it to? And that is a question we never really know, because we really don't know when technological obsolescence comes about. I mean,
there's that, but if I'm saying I'm on the hook, I'm going to design a product that's going to have a 1-year warranty, and we're designing it so that if it lasts for 5 years, our marketing guys will say that that's long enough. I know that with washing machines, they design them so that they have a very low failure rate out to 10 years. Because their marketing group has found that if your white appliance works for 10 years, you're very likely to be happy with that and buy the same brand. Right. So and, it's not a technology obsolescence. It's market acceptance of that's long enough.
Right. And I would say that in washing machines and mechanical systems, that the mechanics wearing out is something that you can model and you can actually measure wear in mechanical systems. And you can project out how long it'll take a belt or a gear or a motor to possibly be consumed and eventually fail because of its wear out. I don't believe, and I haven't seen any evidence, that that's true with the solid-state electronics of today, that you can actually know the lifetime in the components and the lifetime, because everything's changing so fast. The dimensions in semiconductors, the manufacturing methods, we went from lead to leaded solder to lead-free.
It's been 20 years, and we're still trying to sort out the lead-free solder lifetimes.
Right.
And we've got guesses and estimates and models, but we don't
have
50 years of experience.
Right. But I'm, you know, as I say, you know, I've worked on pinball machines that are 20, 25 years old, and they're using, you know, I see the TTO logic and the ICs, and for the most part, they're still working today, and they've been used for, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours or whatever, and they have a pretty stressful environment many times, especially shock and vibration.
Yeah. So let's go back to, I think we agree that these predictions, especially parts count based predictions, are pure folly. And what's disturbing is that even in the 217 document, it says not to be used to estimate how long something will last. It's not what it's for. It's never was designed to be that. Yet that advertisement you mentioned was the most widely used and accepted. Now, I don't think that's the vendor's problem, the software companies that make these things. And I've asked them. I've known folks in all these different organizations that offer this. And they say, you know, what? What are you offering this for? You know, this is ludicrous and they're not using it correctly. You're doing a disservice to the industry. I usually ask it that way, and then we go have a beer if they're still talking to me. But they say, but that's what people are asking us for. That's what we can sell. We can sell them a package, and like the old Relics, which doesn't exist anymore, they got sold off, and I think there's still some version of it out there. But they would sell you a monthly subscription to all the updated components.
Right, but where were those coming from, Fred?
There was no general effort. So it was all completely folly. But people were what they would tell me is that we offer it because people buy it, and I think.
And why do people buy it?
Because
why are people asking?
Yeah, because for $1,000, I can get in a half hour of dump my bomb in there. I can get a number. I get an MTBF value, which is another.
It's a meaningless number, right? It's a meaningless number.
But then they can go to their boss and say, or their vendor, or their supplier, or whatever, and say, "This has got 58,000 hours MTBF." And
yeah, prove it.
Well, no, and then that's where the discussion ends. They think, "Oh, we wanted to know how long it lasts. They gave us 58,000 hours.
Okay.
None of us understand it. We don't know where the numbers came from. We know it's not valid. We're just going to wink, wink, nod, nod. We'll use that, and we're done." And then they're surprised when things work or don't work as expected. But I don't think it's the suppliers and their advertising, their marketing is going, well, we're going to do social proof here that it is widely used. It's freely available. There's all these competitors offering these packages. And even internally, they probably know that most of their customers use that 217 package. And they're going, well, it's the most popular and it's accepted. They can support that because people are giving us money for it. They're looking for it. They're asking for it. They're paying for it. So I don't think it's the supplier's problem. I think they have a chance to fix this problem by not offering it anymore. But they're in business to make money, and they're making money selling this stuff. And it's, to me, it's snake oil. They're selling a feel-good salve that, you know, makes everybody smell good and they think they've done a good job and everybody moves on and doesn't do anything useful. And actually
and
more
that's
harm
the
than
damage.
Good.
It's much, much more harm Fred, and it causes much more costly development time, and it distracts from the finding of real weaknesses in the product, because there's no, you know, every product's unique. The technology is changing too fast. So, in 3 years,
customers keep changing how they use it.
Customers, and they find new ways to adopt the use of it, or add it on to another system, mm-hmm. or something else. And so, again, you know, I stress that you really can't know the life cycle stresses of your. The distribution is very difficult, especially in consumer products or products like automobiles that have just incredible environmental stress distributions, very different. And so knowing how each one of those stresses affects each mechanism in the assembly is just a phenomenal would be a phenomenal data task.
Right.
And if you did have that, it's just like weather. If you had all the factors, every single barometric pressure every second, even that, we still are not very good at forecasting weather beyond a week. So
well, in your part of the world, it's by the next hour.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, it's
but the fact that we think we can predict years in life of electronics. First of all, you've got to identify what mechanism you're saying is going to be the dominant leading mechanism in the assembly, whether it's solder joint cracks, whether it's semiconductor time
electromigration, or it could be ESD, could be somebody driving a forklift over it.
Right. And besides that, besides the inherent things, Fred, you've got the variation in manufacturing. And that's where I've observed a huge amount of unreliability comes from, is in this long chain of, you know, say a semiconductor. He's got the package. He's got the chip itself. He's got the wire bonds. He's got the epoxy, you know, the lead frame, all these. And each one comes from a different supplier, say for the epoxies and things like that. Any one of those guys can produce a contaminant in the epoxy, or produce a flaw in the wireframes, or whatever. And you just there's a huge potential is almost, you know, it's hundreds or thousands of potential mechanisms that could, or failures of process that could cause it, a late defect, as we call it, and becomes a failure in the field.
So we agree. There's no doubt about it, right? That these predictions based on historical database type things is just folly. Yet people still want to know, will this work? Right. Now, I think what another thing you and I can agree on is go find out, you know, get some prototypes and force them to fail. See where you got margins. See where you don't have margins. See what fails and what doesn't fail. You know, we talked about connectors and cables recently.
Right.
And let's connect the cables and see if they survive a shipping experience or not.
You know? And we might be surprised how much stress we can apply to those things and it doesn't break. And that gives us a lot of opportunity then to compare trade-offs and designs between, say, different components used
or more
different vendors. Components.
I think more importantly is if I've got a lot of margin someplace, well, what areas do I not have a lot of margin? Let's work on those.
Right.
If I really want to improve it. Yeah, I agree with you is that if it's something's way over design, we can do cost reduction. But on today's product, I think the more urgent thing is what's the most likely thing to fail and what can we do about that? You know, it's all this stuff that's over design. That's the next program. Let's fix the things that are going to limit the life today.
Well, yeah, I would be careful about using that over design because, you know, I've had a manager ask, well, okay, I said it's got this much it's got a huge margin beyond that. Well, can we trade that off for money? Can we reduce that margin and save some money? And I'm thinking, well, I don't think so because you're using standard components and standard processes. And what would you reduce? I mean, change a rating on a IC, and there's no need to do that, and you're not going to save that much money. Plus, you're going to have a tremendous risk of, making it a weaker your system.
Well, think of the, I think it was the 777. Was that the first Boeing aircraft that had the composite wings?
Yeah, right. Right?
So one of the things I remember about their book is in the design and testing of those, of that plane, was a lot of discussion about the wings. And they take a wing out and they instrument it all up and they bend it till it breaks. And it's
right.
Versus all their models of, well, where mm-hmm. should it break, right? And
right.
they're, and because it's a new material and they weren't sure, they made it thicker and stiffer than they needed to. And
right.
and so it had 20% more weight than they really needed over their margins and safety factors that they wanted.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So over time, they thinned it out a bit and saved a bunch of material and weight, which is the big fat
right.
deal on aircraft design.
Right.
But their initial mm-hmm. design was way beyond, because of the uncertainty. And it's part of the reason why the Brooklyn Bridge is still standing. It was way
right.
over designed. It
right.
It never anticipated the amount of traffic and how long it was standing. But the guy was designing this huge suspension bridge, and he made columns and piers and cables way bigger than any calculation would suggest was necessary. And it was because of the uncertainty. He just made
right.
it bigger and thicker and heavier. So I think there are places to trim. It's got to be done
right.
smart. It's got to be done
on the bridge. He didn't know how long, again, it was going to be used for. He
mm-hmm.
didn't, you know, did he, somebody say 100 years? And how would he know, you know, so the
yeah.
best,
right. Well,
best
part of it was
scenario for him was to overdesign it, or what was considered maybe overdesigned at the time.
Well, he
but as
also,
a safety system,
I mean, that,
also
that, yeah, that particular story about the bridge and the cables was, I think Adam brought it up once. It was that he knew that all of his wire vendors were going to cheat him. Right.
Yeah.
He just knew he was going
right.
to get substandard material
right.
and they weren't going to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
So he made it twice as big so that even with the variability of the materials and the construction, it would still
right.
work.
He kind of derated it, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But so I think there's places to do all that. Now, I want to get back to this issue. Why do people look for that shortcut of I'm just going to do a parts count prediction? I pay a company that says it's common. It's one of these catch-22s. The vendors can claim it's popular because a lot of people buy it. Well, a lot of people buy
right.
it because the vendors are saying it's popular. But there's also this connection in there that for a couple of $1,000 and an afternoon of work, I can come up with a number. Whether it's useful
right.
or not, I think we have our opinions on
that's
that.
Right.
And
it's a lot less costly than actually going and testing a product.
Testing it or
samples.
Evaluating it or doing the
you're
engineering
right.
judgment, doing
absolutely.
The FMEA, doing the due diligence to understand where your risks are, get the design right,
right
check your uncertainties.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is the way to do it.
Well, sure. But it's something management doesn't want to spend the money for testing. They would also hear when we talk about testing to failure or testing to find operational or destruct limits, they would say, no, we're not going to do that. It's not relevant. And so it's a quick way and it doesn't require any samples. And all it you know requires is a bomb. And because it's been so many decades that this belief has been established, and because reliability, the actual failure causes a failure in products, as we've seen, you know, our products we know, such as the Xbox, Red Ring of Death, we'll never see the causes. Engineers don't get to understand unless they're in companies
mm-hmm.
and go
and
through
there,
and look into failure analysis. And even there, it's very difficult because it may be in a remote place. It may be with the vendors doing the FAA and not disclosing what mistakes they may have made in manufacturing.
Yeah, yeah.
This is very true. So it's we continue with this mythology of MIL Handbook 217 and reliability prediction, a continued reliance on a misleading approach.
Yeah, that sounds like an article.
Paper.
You did.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a paper by the U.S. Army, and you can find it on my website, and I've linked to it many times, or you
yeah.
can search for that article.
Well, even just that reliability growth, the Peck and a whole crew of people wrote up. It's a free ebook, and it's a pretty
yeah.
extensive book, but it goes into debunking this prediction stuff and
right,
focusing
right,
more
right.
on physics of failure.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. There's it just keeps going. So, no, you would appreciate
it keeps
this
going
one.
The management asks it. It's like MTBF. Management keeps asking for MTBF, you know?
Right.
Not, so understand.
This one, when I told this story or a similar story in discussion with a guy out of Denmark, I think he's from, and his company, and they make really good pumps, really good industrial pumps and motors for those pumps. And
yes,
they have internally. He has an internally. They had a website that had this fortune teller guy with the Swami hat and, you know, and this crystal ball in front of him. So you want to know the MTBF of your product? Please press the button. The Swami knows all, or something like that. Right? You push the button. These numbers roll on a little clicker thing, and it comes up with a number. And then it comes up with a screen that says, "Don't like that number? Push the button again."
Yeah, exactly.
And then you want to know how to really understand the reliability of your product? Come, you know, here's our contact. Come talk to us or whatever. And I thought it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And but people love fortune tellers, you know, people love that. It's like, and you know that they never go back. It's just like the predictions that were made on electronic products. Nobody goes back and says, well, you said that we're going to be, you know,
rich and famous by 22. And that product's going to work.
Right. And look at this. You know, we've had this many failures. And, well, they didn't do exactly what, you know, they were supposed to do. You know, well, that's the reason we have unreliability is because.
Maybe that's what we should do, Kirk. Instead of doing consulting and running tests and then evaluating design for reliability, is set up a fortune teller shop on predicting the reliability of your system.
That's right. And come back in 3 years and, you know, if our reliability prediction's wrong, come back in 3 years and tell us about it.
That's right. And we would tell you that, you know, your customers changed or you didn't follow the procedure correctly.
Or your vendors screwed up or
something
like that.
Yeah, we predicted you would be wrong. Yeah, we predicted you would be wrong. You have a 50% chance of getting this number.
Yeah, right.
You might or you might not. We're not sure. Have a good day. Leave your money at the door.
Right. So I there's really no simple cure for this issue and dependence on reliability prediction because of the fact that we really can't share real failure rates. But I think that any engineer working in a company, if he goes into his own failure analysis and looks at if he can get access to the actual root causes of failures, he'll see they have nothing to do with the factors that are in these predictions because they're not intrinsic failure mechanisms that usually cause especially warranty failures during a warranty period or within, you know, on a solid state electronic assemblies within 2 or 3 years of use, they're not generally a intrinsic mechanism that's semiconductor or Arrhenius, you know, or
say like related or any of that kind of stuff. Usually not.
Yeah. Electrolytic capacitors are known to wear out and they can be misformulated, the electrolyte, and that's been a problem in the field. But it's usually mismanufacturing or some error somewhere along the supply chain that causes a weakness to come into a good design. And that can happen anytime. You can have a robust design become just crap in the field when somebody didn't manufacture something correctly. And it's hard to find that.
You're right. It's hard to find, but manufacturing can't make your product better. They can only make your design. They can only make it worse. And so it's always the designer's fault, always. But that's just my old manufacturing engineer days talking.
But that's where margin gives you some safety is the fact that you can have more variation when you have a product with a lot of margin, more margin. You can tolerate more variation in some of the components or a lot of the
And different customers, the way they use it. Yeah. So anyway, we did a lot of agreeing, but I think we still have this problem out there. So let's open this up to our listeners. You know, how do you deal with this, right?
Right. How can we get away from reliability prediction? And why do so many feel it's still a valid methodology for reliability development?
Well, that might be a subject for another one. When we get some feedback and list the common excuses, and I'm going to use it very deliberately use, it's just a poor excuse to say, well, everybody's doing it, or it's what the boss wanted, or this or that. We've always done it that way. Okay. So there's three of them to start. And I bet you there's a couple dozen more out there. So head over to reliability.fm. You can find Speaking of Reliability and the other podcast shows within the reliability.fm podcast network. And you can find plenty of places to leave comments and feedback for us, and we'd love to hear from you. Reach out to us on LinkedIn or through ratings and reviews, or our preferred method, and hopefully it's convenient for you, is at reliability.fm. And let us know what kind of excuses you've run into.
Right. Just like finding the weaknesses in products, we'd like to find what you want to hear most about. And please give us your questions, and we'll try and answer them best we can.
Yeah, well said, Kirk. So thanks a lot, and we'll sit down and have a cup of coffee again in the near future.
Okay, thanks, Fred.
Take care, Kirk.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.